Major Spoilers theme song.
The Major Spoilers podcast is on the air. On the air. The Major Spoilers podcast is on the air. On the air. Podcast.
I'm Matthew.
I'm Rodrigo.
And I'm Steven. I've been listening to the Major Spoilers podcast.
The Major Spoilers podcast is on the air.
Welcome to the Major Spoilers Podcast, the podcast for pop culture and comic fans. This week, it is a general topic episode.
General topic.
How do we know that it's a general topic episode? Because if you look at your keyboard, we made this show using the letter between Y and I. Have you guys seen that meme floating around your Twitter?
Anytime I see it, though, I see it on my phone, and I'm like, I am not pulling up the keyboard for
this. I think
this.
It's all just nonsense.
Yeah.
Well, one of them is the character's name is Yui, Y-U-I. Mm-hmm. So the joke is that she is on the letters between T and O. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's just, it's, you know, it's anime stuff. Anime people are just a wacky brand of wacky, and I think they're awesome. And
they're doing their own thing.
Yeah, just like in the old days, you know?
Yeah.
When we were all locked in the basement trying to trade old Atlas.
Screaming to get out, but your grandmother kept you locked in there while she murdered the kids who were filming a porn movie out in the barn. Yeah.
Finally saw X, did you?
No. But speaking of, did you guys watch the new Deadpool and Wolverine movie trailer?
Deadpool.
I did see it, yeah.
Yeah, what'd you think, Rodrigo?
It looks okay. Looks like they're going with like a Wolverine from a different dimension, so they probably get to structure it, structure his backstory however they want, and doesn't necessarily have to be in continuity with Logan. And
yeah, that's what I think some people are complaining about is like, oh, but the Logan movie wrapped up Wolverine perfectly, and it's like, no, this is like Old Man Logan from the comic books, ladies and gentlemen. This is not Logan from the Logan
so,
movie.
You know, are we going to get a Venom T-Rex? Only time will tell.
You hope that there's a Venom T-Rex?
I'm just saying, we could get one. But I know they've shown Pyro right from the first couple X-Men movies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So there is a chance that we're going to get some, like, what are now, like, deep cuts, right, from those movies. Right. That they might bring back, like, the actress who played Jubilee, like, super briefly. That they might bring back the kid who, like, changes the channel by blinking. You know, you just never know.
Yeah.
You know what that kid's name is?
What?
Blink.
Is it really?
Yeah.
That must have made it very awkward when they actually introduced Blink later on.
Oh, yeah. It's creepy. Best part is they actually introduced Blink before that. But... yeah, because Blink came around, didn't she? God help me, Rodrigo. Thanks.
I don't mean in the comics. Like, Blink eventually makes it into the movies.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, does she? Oh.
Yeah, she's in the Days of Future Past stuff.
Oh, I don't know if that counts.
Days of Future Past is a good movie.
It is a good movie, but it doesn't really have anything to do with the X-Men that we know from the comics. Like, their Sunspot is actually a guy who shoots flame for some reason, and
oh sure,
Thunderbird
just within that, like, what is it, Fox cinematic X-Men stuff. I mean, it like Days of Future Past is basically there to erase X3,
right?
But then they did Apocalypse after that, and I was like, yeah
Apocalypse was not.
Yeah, exactly. It's not like, a winner. Oh, good. It's like we're finishing the trilogy with X3. People hate X3. We're finishing the trilogy by erasing X3.
Yeah.
Like, okay. Now we're gonna make another one, and it's gonna be so at best. And it's like, ah.
But they redeemed themselves and closed it all out with Logan. So
that's true.
Yeah.
See, but I know they have Pym Falls. Did you see Pym Falls in the trailer?
Yes, I saw, and the Ant-Man helmet that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's a very cool visual.
Yeah.
That is an excellent physical.
It would be interesting, though. I mean, surely they won't do Hillbilly Hulk and his Hillbilly kids.
I will bet you even money they reference it because it's a Ryan Reynolds joint.
Yeah, they could.
And these guys like to make fun of
things. They put a nice dig on Rob Liefeld in there.
Well, of course. They did that in the first movie, too. Who would name a guy like that? Probably a guy who can't throw a fake.
Yeah. But
I'm a little bit psyched to once and for all finally have a Wolverine in a Wolverine costume and not like a black leather outfit. Even if it's the blue and gold Wolverine costume, which I, you know, don't like as much as the two-tone brown.
Mm-hmm.
I like that they're willing to commit to a costume, because I think that is the second biggest failing of live action superhero stories, even today, is they refuse to commit to these things. X-Men actually had a joke about how stupid it would be to wear yellow spandex.
Yeah, it's oh, go ahead. Sorry.
No, it's okay. You know, 25 years later, now we have Hugh Jackman in yellow. Well, that's probably leather.
It's not spandex.
Yeah. But it's like plastic. It's like,
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Textured leather, whatever they use.
Yeah, it's interesting because all of these movies, all of the superhero movies exist together and are in like conversation with each other as time goes by, right? And, you know, when you look back at the X-Men movie, it's like, was that came out before the Spider-Man movie, right? So yeah, it's like,
X-Men came out in like 2002. Spider-Man was 2008. I don't know.
Yeah. So the first Spider-Man movie got changed because of 9/11. So it must have come out around then.
2002 was the first Spider-Man movie, it looks like.
Okay.
Yeah. So the X-Men film was
2000.
Yeah. So again, you get Blade right as this like prototypical like new superhero movie.
Right.
That, and then right after that, the next entry, other than other Blade movies, is the X-Men, right? So X-Men is like the only palette that we have here is the Blade movies and we can expand on that. And it does, you know, it makes the costumes a little bit more costumey, even though they all look like, you know, like bikers.
That's probably Matrix. That's probably the Matrix influence.
I mean, the Matrix is kind of a counter influence, right? The Matrix is like, look at all these guys in suits fighting. How cool is that?
I mean, black leather is what they were wearing a lot of the times, not just suits. Especially when you look at Neo and Trinity when they get in all their getup. And so I think when you look at the X-Men, you're like, oh, all black. That's what superheroes are wearing.
I don't think that people said let's put Jean Grey in a tan and blue costume that goes up to her chin, and then they looked at the Matrix and they were like, no, let's put her in leather instead. Like we weren't there yet, right? Like the first Iron Man, they went extremely out of their way to show the mechanicalness, the physicality of the Iron Man armor and how it goes on and latches on.
Yep.
And how, you know, you need a robot to help put it on. By the time we get to Infinity War, Iron Man basically has a Sailor Moon transformation sequence to put it on, right? It's like, if you had, they could have done that in the 90s, in fact, or in the 2000s. In fact, they probably wanted to. They were like, what if the thing is made of nanites? And somebody was like, no, superheroes need to be believable. If you make a superhero impractical or maybe practical and unbelievable, people will reject it, right? So all of these movies have slowly pushed our ability to accept, I mean, not our ability, us three, we're huge nerds. We would have accepted anything. But the general public's ability to accept a superhero that's dressed like a superhero, right? Like, I think the final step in that was prior to this Wolverine was the MCU Spider-Man, right? His suit looks like it's made of spandex, like it's made of stretchy cloth, right? Mm-hmm. Something that they absolutely felt they couldn't do with the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man. They're like, this has to be look like a basketball that's had like steel, like steel rods melted over it, right? It can't look like it's just made of cloth. That would be ridiculous. So well, it's taken
it
a
too, part of that too has to do with how does it look on screen, And certainly when you're in the early days of digital.
The question of, how do we digitally reproduce this and CGI it? And
yeah,
I wonder if it's a question of the black being easier too. So,
But that only carries you so far. Do you remember the first Spider-Man movie? Do you remember that scene where Tobey Maguire's stunt double is running across a rooftop and then he jumps, turns into a sack of unbelievable potatoes and then lands on the other side? Like they were doing CGI to do like cloth already and it looked like it looked, right? So I firmly believe that it's like Spider-Man's costume is like reflective. Like if they were like, oh, we have to do it because we have to have conservative CGI so that it looks good, they wouldn't have designed that costume. They would have probably tried to do something that was a little bit more believable or something that was even wackier so that if it looked unbelievable on screen, people were like, well, that's a crazy costume anyway. Like, I really feel that like this Wolverine gets to wear yellow because when Hugh Jackman first wore a leather jacket, he was like pushing the envelope of superheroes ever so slightly. And like 20 years later or however long it's been, we finally get to have a guy who actually I don't remember from the trailer. Does he have his like his underwear on the outside?
No, but
so we're not even there yet, gentlemen. We are not even there yet. There is still a ways to go.
And I'm pretty sure Hugh Jackman is pantless in the whole trailer that we've seen so far.
I feel like, though, Rodrigo, you make a very valid argument. And I think to extend it, it's all Batman's fault. Because if you're not a comics fan, if you're somebody who just grows up watching these movies and seeing, you know, the films and the pop culture expand out, in a lot of ways, it feels like 89 Batman is sort of that flashpoint where it all began. And if you look at that movie and then you expand from there, we're just all trying to escape the shadow of Michael Keaton, who did finally get to have underpants on the outside last year in the Flash movie.
There you go. There's something else there, I think, because the big outlier is like, well, what about Superman, right? What about the 78 Superman? Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 77.
Like that's just straight up Superman from the comics. His underwear is on the outside. He's got a spit curl. He's being a Boy Scout. Like everybody loves Superman. And then it's like we couldn't go back. And I wonder if it wasn't like sort of like these like abortive attempts in the like between Superman and the next time the Batman franchise or the like the Tim Burton Batman stuff where they were like, yeah. Superhero costumes don't look good on screen, or you can't do superheroes on screen because, again, you had this like prototype of Superman, and for some reason, everybody was too scared to do it afterward.
Well, part of it is too. I don't know if you've ever seen Christopher Reeve during that time period. That dude was pretty jacked for the time period.
Sure.
So, even in the costume, even though it hangs a little bit more straight than what you would think of a Superman illustration. By the time you get up to 89, people are like, Michael Keaton isn't jacked. He needs muscles. Let's go with this plastic shell of a costume. And so that's when you start getting into the, let's amp this up. Let's add padding. Let's do all of these things that you're not going to be able to do. Unless the actor is really jacked. And speaking of jacked, if you look at Hugh Jackman, that dude is jacked. And so he, you know, if you look in the trailer, I don't think he has sleeves on his costume because he's got the guns to back that up. Ryan Reynolds is pretty jacked, but that suit, you know, hides a lot of imperfections. What's his name? Who played Shazam? That dude's jacked too. He got really jacked. A lot of that, his costume is not padding. So part of the discussion is number one, what looks good on screen? And there is an expectation that, especially in the '80s with your comic books, that everybody is muscular and jacked and all that stuff. And so you have to try to recreate that in the movies. The other thing, as far as when you get into Spider-Man and the X-Men, it is, I will lean into the Matrix probably had a greater influence on the look of the X-Men than people think. But by the time you get to Spider-Man, it's a very flat costume. And if you look at the film quality of Superman in the 70s and compare that to the Spider-Man of the 2000s, film and technology have changed dramatically. So if you just had a guy in a red and blue costume running around, it would fall really flat. If you didn't have all the ribbing, if you didn't have all the other little doohickeys, greebles, or whatever that you want to call them on the costume, you're going to be losing some of that. So then once they did it in Spider-Man and they allow it to be CGI, then they're like, oh, well, that certainly saves us stunt work. And we only have to do maybe one or two costumes instead of 32 costumes because they're constantly getting ripped. So this will save us a lot of money. And hey, we would like you to look good, but you don't have to go and bulk up. Certainly there are a few actors that have done that. Dave Bautista was already that way. Paul Rudd had a fairly rigorous
They all kind of do, right? It's like there's a shot of Tobey Maguire looking totally ripped in Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. So they clearly went in and it's like they're all doing it.
Yeah.
And I see what you're saying, that it's, you know, partially to hide the imperfections of the human body.
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher Reeve did not have those. Christopher Reeve was cast because he looked like Superman. He was 6'4", like Superman, broad shoulder, dark hair, blue eyes. And that, I think, is something that in the context of Hugh Jackman as Wolverine is important, because Reeve was cast because he looked like Superman, but happened to be a really good actor. And later characters, especially, you know, your Michael Keatons, your Hugh Jackman, who is a full foot too tall to play Wolverine.
Sure.
Yeah. Wolverine is 5'3" tall.
I mean, that's fine.
That is canonical truth. And so Hugh Jackman is 6'3", but I also feel like that may be a good thing, because when they cast Michael Keaton, you know, chubby, doughy Mr. Mom to play Batman, and he did it as well as he did, I think it did open up that expectation that these stories are going to be more than just, we have to pick a guy who looks like the character and do the best special effects we can, you know?
So slight change of topic here, if you'll allow me.
Okay.
Did, when I first read it, when they were coming out, that wasn't imagined.
Oh, okay.
This is like the original issues, nerd.
Okay.
Like the new X-Men, right, were like controversial.
Mm-hmm.
Like some people were really, really not into them, and I think vocally not into them.
The new X-Men comic series.
Yeah. So, okay. Like, is it Morrison? Grant Morrison?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Grant Morrison, Frank Quitely.
Quitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So. But recently, just out there, I've started seeing that like people are really into it. In fact, X-Men 97 did a riff on that run just recently. Was that, so bringing it back to this, was that Cassandra Nova in the trailers? And are we interested or disgusted or excited by that?
If it is Cassandra Nova, I am psyched.
Mm-hmm.
And I say that knowing that I shouldn't be psyched, and knowing that comic book films, however you define that, are notorious for, we have to have the character who is the perfect dark mirror, and this is, you know, an evil, literal evil twin of Charles Xavier. But I also feel like Cassandra Nova as a character has potential that I have not seen them do in comics before. And it could, even if they do the thing that they have been doing with the X-Men, where, you know, they've kind of blunted a lot of what Magneto, what his rhetoric was, even with, you know, Michael Rapaprapaprapa. Who was that?
Oh, Michael Fassbender?
Fassbender. Thank you. I always get them confused. I think Michael Rapaport. And then I'm like, wait, was Michael Rapaport the guy who talked like this?
Yeah, that's a different guy.
Okay.
That guy is briefly in the Fallout show. And also a huge jerk, from what I hear. Tired. I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. He is apparently, if you ever watch his tickety tockety feed, he's apparently just
That's Cassandra Nova.
Contrasition.
Yeah. Yeah. Looks. Yeah. That's
no,
so
no, it
that's
is.
What
it,
I, it's, oh, it is. Yes. They're saying that it is.
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Which is good, because now we can see.
Do you remember that? Do you like that character, Steven? Do you care?
I don't know that character.
Yeah. She has recently been part of the crew of Marauders during the Krakoa era. Mm-hmm. You know, Kitty Pryde's little pirate ship full of Yar, we are happy, happy pirates. And she and this is a team, by the way. She and Iceman and Bishop and a couple of other villains and Cassandra Nova were at one point the crew of Kitty Pryde's ship. And I'm just like, what the heck?
Yeah, the Krakoa era is very interesting for a lot of reasons. And we talked about it a little bit when we reviewed it, when we reviewed like Powers of X and House of X or whatever.
Yep.
But there's a lot to talk about there, about, you know, the philosophy of the Krakoa run, but maybe not for the Deadpool trailer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not up on X-Men like you guys. It was not a series that for me was easy to get into at the time. And sure. Every time I've tried to go into it, it's like, all right, here are some people. We'll call this one Charles Xavier. Here's Wolverine. Here's Cyclops. Here's Kitty Pryde. Here's Nightcrawler. And it's like, okay, I can get behind this. Now, here are 14,000 other people showing up, and you are expected to know all of them. And I'm like, yeah, no, I don't. So I lose interest very quickly. Yeah, I lose interest very quickly whenever they do those kinds of things. And that goes for any comic series, right? I mean, this even goes on DC side, too. You know, if they just start pulling out all these people that you're expected to know, then that is, I think for many people, is a detractor. Because it's like, oh, well, I don't know this guy. Is this subtle gatekeeping, meaning that if I don't know this guy, I shouldn't be reading this comic book? Because certainly there's a lot of people out there who will tell you that if you don't know who Cassandra Nova is, then you have no business going and watching a Deadpool and Wolverine movie or reading comic books. I was going to say, it just feels a little gatekeepery at times when they do that. And so for me, whenever it's like, here's 32 people you should know, and I don't know a single one of them, I'm just kind of like, yeah, I'm going to check out, because I know if I say anything, people are going to just try to be mean.
Yeah. X-Men comics in the 90s and maybe early 2000s too were impenetrable.
Mm-hmm.
I would not have been able to get into X-Men if not for two reasons. One, the X-Men cartoon, absolutely 100%. That was like fantastic onboarding for the X-Men.
Yeah.
You know, they were like the X-Men from like the previous decade.
Yeah.
But you know, a lot of them were still around or they'd show up or whatever. And then the other two is that Joe Madureira and Carlos Pacheco were like drawing X-Men at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I don't understand what's happening here, but I love this art. And that's how I got into X-Men.
Yeah. I think a lot of times, you know, especially when you know, Atomic Robo, it's like, yeah, go start at the beginning. That's a good place to start.
Sure.
Critical Hit, Void Saga, start at the beginning. That's the best place to start. I think with like X-Men, Justice League, a lot of these, I think it's even Spider-Man, even the current run of Spider-Man, although every time there's a creator change, there's a new number one. So you don't have to be as knowledgeable. But I think that in the case of X-Men and Justice League, I think sometimes you just have to pick up an issue, read through it. If you like it, go get the next issue, and then just keep working your way through it until you figure it out. Thankfully, there's things like Wikipedia out there that can answer a lot of those questions. But, you know, a lot of times it's just like keep hammering away at it until it clicks, and then you're a fan.
I feel like I treat how should I get into X-Men the same way I treated my child's first questions about SEX, which are, if you're old enough to ask the questions, then you're probably old enough to do some actual research on it, because honestly, you don't get into X-Men accidentally. Yeah, like Rodrigo, I got into X-Men when it was completely impenetrable, but I really loved that Paul Smith art, which, you know, then transitioned into John Romita Jr.'s run. And I'm like, okay, I'm here. I don't know who all these people are, but they slowly show you who these idiots are. And I feel like, and I say this with love as your longtime co-host on Legion Podcast, I don't think it's intentional gatekeeping so much as it
no,
is.
It's not intentional. It's not intentional gatekeeping. Yeah. I never would say that it's intentional gatekeeping. I feel like it's maybe unintentional or subtle gatekeeping that people don't realize they're doing when you suddenly have a character who hasn't been around in 12, 18, 32 issues suddenly makes a reappearance. And then everyone's like, you mean you don't know who this Pulsar Stargrave is? It's like, no, this guy hasn't been around for 6 years. Oh, come on, man. Right. You know,
it enables purposeful gatekeeping, right?
Because
the continuity is so fractured, and because it's so fractured, but yet they are so slavish to it, like
and they're slavish to different like bits and shadows. Yeah,
every writer comes in and they picks out the chunks that they like, which again, you know, major spoilers, F continuity, right? Like every writer should be able to come in, pick the chunks of X-Men that they like, and tell a new X-Men story with the stuff they like, make up some new stuff, and it shouldn't be absolutely tied to the previous continuity, right?
And again, I think that's why, for me, when I got into the X-Men again in the 90s, again, Mojo World was probably that first time where I was like, well, I'm just going to plow through this.
Sure.
No, good Lord, no, don't do that. But I think the biggest problem in a lot of these big title books or big ensemble cast books is, and I think Wayne has talked about this the last couple of weeks on the comics portal, is all these crossover stories where, hey, if you really want to understand what's going on in X-Force, you need to go read X-Men, and you need to go read whatever Cable is doing, and you need to go read this Wolverine series and then this other Wolverine series. And so I think that is also a little bit intimidating, where these books now have become very interconnected, that if you don't know what's going on in one, then you don't know what's going on in anything else.
I feel like I almost kind of prefer that to what we got a lot of in the 70s and the first half of the 80s, though, because what would happen when, you know, say, okay, so Richard Rider, Nova, you guys know him from Guardians of the Galaxy, New Warriors, whatever. He had a series in 76. At the end of 20 issues of that series, when that series ended, they gave him a Fantastic Four arc, which closed it all up, took away his powers, threw it all out the thing. Nova is no longer a thing since his book is no longer being printed. We have disabled him and taken him off the board entirely. There is no more Nova in the Marvel Universe. And that was the status quo until 1989. And I honestly prefer that theory of he was never seen, he was never heard from again, but he's off having adventures.
Sure.
And if you decide, I want to bring back, say, the guy who just pleased me the other week that I found in an issue of Iron Man. Do you remember Jumbo Carnation?
Yes.
The mutant fashion designer? Jumbo Carnation just pops up in an issue of Iron Man because Iron Man, I don't know if you know this, Tony Stark married Emma Frost. And Emma Frost and Tony Stark, are a married couple now. And they needed costumes to go to the Hellfire Club, which, by the way, is now owned and operated by Wilson Fisk, the former kingpin of crime. And so Emma called in a favor, and Jumbo Carnation shows up in his big cowboy boots and his feather boa. And he's like, I will make you an amazing dress. Those are the things that I like to see. Jumbo Carnation hasn't been a thing probably since New X-Men.
I mean, Jumbo Carnation's first appearance is being dead. Like, you actually don't even see him. The first thing you see is like a chalk outline.
And you're just like, hey, there you go. But yeah, I comparatively prefer that sort of this guy pops up later and then we all have to go, oh, wait, who is this idiot? I've never seen him before. He hasn't been around for 5 years. Than the absolute closed endings that we got during, you know, the Shooter era. And to a lesser degree, the Giordano era over at DC, because DC was very guilty of this, too, for a while.
Yeah.
But I mean, some of my favorite characters are just guys who popped up.
Oh, there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with that. It's, you know, Jumbo Carnation showing up, and then, you know, all he does is he comes in and says, I will design you the most perfect, you know, dress ever, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, leaves. And then they're like, never mention his name, never do anything. And the only people who know who that person is are the people who remember who that character is. And there's never an explanation. I really do miss editor's boxes. I think Marvel is doing probably the best right now when they do the previously in on the inside front cover of their books. So you can at least do some catching up, or if you're a first time reader, kind of get into that story. But I really miss the editor's box saying, you know, this is Jumbo Carnation, you know, costumer of the mutants, Excelsior, you know, first appeared in X-Men 32 or whatever it was.
Or in sort of in the text of the thing, give them a an explanation that is like that is proportional to their impact on the book, right?
Yeah, if they're a cameo, have Emma Frost say, "Oh, Tony, I know the perfect thing. I'm going to call Jumbo Carnation. He'll get a setup."
Yeah,
right.
I don't know. That's my thing about an ensemble, large ensemble stuff. Is you have to be very careful.
I will say this. The one nice thing about how impenetrable properties like X-Men, Legion, probably a lot of like Image stuff is like, what has ever happened in Witchblade? And it's like, well, how much time do you have? Sit down.
Mm-hmm.
It has literally enabled people like us to create media around it. It's like, former contributor to this podcast, Ashley, has a whole series about like, so you want to like get into this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, here's what you need to know. Also, like, history lessons on individual characters. Exactly.
Geek History Lesson podcast does a lot of that stuff.
Yeah. So, like, all of that, like, is enabled by the fact that it's actually pretty difficult to get into that stuff. It's like, you might think, like, oh, I'll just go to marvel.com or whatever.
Well, like I said, unfortunately,
find out their bios, but obviously not every character has bios there.
Yeah.
And those bios are not super complete because they're just going to put the stuff that is either relevant to the current run, or, you know, they might not talk about stuff that is controversial or that has been
Give you the
erased by continuity
view of a character like Spider-Man. And it's useless. Don't ever go to Marvel.com. There's no information
so,
there.
So, Rodrigo, it's funny that you mentioned Witchblade.
Uh-huh.
Because a new Witchblade series arrives in July.
What?
Yeah, it's going to be, they're going to reintroduce the world to the characters with a reimagined origin with contemporary takes on familiar characters. Marguerite Bennett will be writing the series with, let me see if I can find out, Giuseppe Cafaro is going to do the art on this. So Top Cow reached out to us a couple of weeks ago. Getting everybody prepped and excited about this. Mark Silvestri is very excited about what's going on. You can see some of the first cover and interior art from the series over at majorspoilers.com. I'll put a link here for you guys to check out, and I will put a link in the show notes for everybody to check out. So yeah, you've got that coming for you. Question. Do you prefer something that is familiar with a slight twist, or do you want something new and untested? You know, like, how do you like your steak? You know, Brad and I were talking about this the other day, in that Brad is like, you know, I like to go out and get a steak and cook it on the grill and put on some salt and pepper or whatever and cook it to the way that I like it and bring it in and eat it. And I know that I'm getting a steak, and I know what that is going to be, what that experience is. Do you guys prefer, you know, the steak that you're familiar with, or do you want to go to a place that you've never heard of before and they serve steak? ?
I mean, for me, that changes. I definitely enjoy trying new things with the expectation always that I might not like them, right? If I'm going to a new place, then I'm like, okay, it's like, especially if it's a restaurant, right? It's like, here's a place that has like 20 things on the menu. I'm going to pick one.
You're always going to go for the hamburger.
I mean, I always go for the hamburger if we go to like maybe not super authentic seeming Mexican place.
Oh, yeah,
like
yeah.
if we go to a place and like the first thing that they have out there is like a taco pizza as mm-hmm. like one of their options, I'm like, okay, I'm getting the burger.
Yeah.
But that's because of, you know, my own personal sensibilities. If it's like an American type place, yeah, I'll often get the burger because chances are we are like downtown or doing something else. And I know that the burger is going to, I'm going to be able to eat it and probably won't mess with me in any sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
So I know that I can handle a burger. But yeah, if like the point is you go out to a new restaurant that you haven't tried before, like that is fun and that's interesting. And if you guys remember the Hot Stone Reuben fiasco story,
mm-hmm.
sometimes it's terrible, but it makes for a good story.
Yeah. What about you, Matthew?
See, this is such a fat guy answer. I actually...
Well, it's not really a food question.
No, but I mean, equivalent, the way that I approach my pop culture is really kind of the way a fat guy approaches food, in that I feel like each has its place. I feel like I can absolutely go to, you know, there's a place here in town, the Blue Moose, which is like a 3-star restaurant, and I can have like a creme brulee and some medallions of lobster with a, you know, a béarnaise sauce and spam. But I can also, you know, today on the way home, I really, really wanted a snack. I sent Stacy into the grocery store to get me some Kansas grocery store sushi. And it was really good. It was excellent. It was just, you know, a dragon roll from the local grocery store. Yeah. And a lot of people would be like, how can you eat grocery store sushi? How can you eat Kansas sushi? How can you, you know, get these little plastic containers and enjoy them? Because there are different expectations. Like, do I like something familiar with a slight twist? I do. But I am famous for saying new things are bad. I don't mean it, because things that are new and untested can also be fascinating. But like, if you have the example of, say you go and you see a movie that is named after your favorite movie. You go and you see, like, I don't
Star
know.
Star Trek the 3, Black The Hole Search 5. For Spock.
Now, that's a direct sequel. I'm talking like if you go and you see, like, Men in Black International is The Adventures of Thor and the Valkyrie, because they had a really, really good rapport and bears virtually no resemblance to the Men in Black films that we know. But it's a cool movie. I think it would have been fine if it were not called Men in Black.
Sure.
Well, it's good that you guys are bringing all of this up, because let me tell you about Rebel Moon Part 2.
No.
Oh, you saw it? It came out already?
Yeah, it came out this past weekend.
Oh, I haven't watched it yet.
I did you watch the first one?
I'm so excited. Yeah, it was so bad.
Yeah. Oh, no, it gets worse. It gets really, really worse. Here's the thing. Nobody cares. Zack Snyder certainly doesn't care what my opinion is.
Sure.
But the premise when he was hyping this was, I wanted to do a Star Wars movie and they wouldn't let me do a Star Wars movie, so I did my own Star Wars movie. Mm-hmm. This isn't a Star Wars movie.
No.
And really, this is The Magnificent Seven, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's only so many times you can do The Magnificent Seven. I mean, certainly if he would have said, hey, this is The Magnificent Seven in space, I think a lot more people would be very open to this, as opposed to, this is my version of Star Wars, and it's not. I mean, yes, Star Wars Rebels did do a Magnificent Seven riff. There's been the Western Magnificent. Magnificent Seven is one of those movies that people remake again and again and again and again.
Yeah. So I just real quick in here, I disagree. I think you can actually keep doing The Magnificent Seven.
No, I think you can.
You have to do it right.
Yeah, no, you're right. You have to do it right. That's what I was getting at. Magnificent Seven is a property you can do again and again and again and again. But the problem is, this is like going to that fancy restaurant where you hear steak and you look at the menu and the first thing on the menu is taco pizza. And you're like, I think I'll have a hamburger at the steak restaurant. Because it is Zack Snyder top to bottom. Yeah. There are things that don't make sense. Like, Rodrigo, did you know that these interstellar spaceships run on coal?
No.
There is a scene where our heroine is in the engine room and she jumps down a level where she throws a guy off and he lands in a pile of coal and she jumps after him. And there are people literally shoveling coal into the furnaces.
See, that's the sort of thing where, like, I feel like a more capable writer. Like, I don't think Zack Snyder's a bad director.
No, I don't think he's a bad director.
I don't think he's a good writer. And like a more capable writer, the reveal that actually these interstellar things run on coal would have been hilarious or really like really would have turned it upside down. Right. It's like all of a sudden you're like, oh, this is why they go around bullying other planets because they need coal to run these giant spaceships. I'd be like, OK, yeah, sure. All right. Yeah. But yeah, if it's just like. Yeah, it's just like, oh, now I want to have the scene where they run through the furnaces in Titanic.
I mean, like, it really feels kind of like that, right? I mean, and it's such a short scene. Like, she throws a guy off the... So there's really, just before she does that, there is a really cool aesthetic piece in the ship that I kind of dug, and you'll see it when you get to it. Sure. But then there's a guard walking through, and she throws him off the catwalk down onto this pile of coal, and I was like, wait, pile of coal? And then she jumps down after him and the people, you know, that are shoveling the coal into the engines are like, oh, we got an intruder here. And I'm like, oh my God, they're literally running this interstellar spaceship off coal. And it's yeah, you're right. Zack Snyder has a good vision. I think he's a good director. I think he has a good aesthetic. But I think that he relies too much on the same old, in that fast, slow, fast. You know what you're getting in a Zack Snyder movie. You know what kind of look, the dark look that you're getting in a Zack Snyder movie. And it is just, I was hoping that this was going to be better than the first, and it's not. It really isn't. I was kind of disappointed.
I assumed.
And the first one was just mid. I mean, as far as what the kids say, right? The first one was mid. And this one was just, what in the heck? There's some more things that I would make fun of, but it's not really my place to be. And I don't say make fun, but point out that these are some inconsistencies in the movie. And isn't that a little weird, everybody? Ha ha. In an uncomfortable laugh. But somebody, you know, I mentioned the coal bit on Twitter earlier this week. And someone says, yeah, somebody really should, you know, pull Zach aside and talk to him about his writing or something along those lines. And I was like, well, listen, it doesn't matter what I say. I'm not in Zack Snyder's sphere of influence. He could listen to this podcast, which he does. If he does, hi, Zack Snyder. I really enjoyed a lot of your other movies. I enjoyed 300. I enjoyed, what's the lollipop candy movie?
Sucker Punch?
Yeah, Sucker Punch. I enjoyed that. My wife even enjoyed 300, which I was surprised on. So we do enjoy a lot of your movies. But Zack Snyder doesn't give two craps what I have to say. I think everyone who knows who Zack Snyder is and sees that this is a Zack Snyder joint are the same people who understand that when you see M. Night Shyamalan's name on a movie, that you go in with certain levels of expectations. And if you go in with certain levels of expectations for Rebel Moon 2, your expectations will be met.
Yeah. So when I was in college, I had a handful of friends that were in the same program as me. And we would definitely get into these things of like, wouldn't it be awesome if they made a movie that X? And like, so we'd start out and be like, wouldn't it be awesome if like they actually did like a good Marvel movie? It's like, yeah. And then like this happens. And it's like, yeah. And then like there's a scene where this happens. And by the end of it, we're like jumping around in the like in our dorm rooms.
Yeah.
Yeah, and being like, and then Ghost Rider reincarnates into the Hulk, and you know, just stuff like that, right?
Yeah,
like just awesome sequence to awesome sequence to awesome sequence, and that's definitely what the first Rebel Moon was.
And that's there's more of that in this, except for a big giant fight at the end where the villagers are like, pile the wheat up against the buildings so they won't blow up the buildings. And then the bad guys are like, oh, they've piled the wheat up against the buildings so that we don't destroy the wheat. Okay, I'll send in the ground troops. And what are the first thing the ground troops are doing? Blowing up the buildings with the weed around them.
Yeah, it's, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Zack Snyder does do very good action sequence to action sequence scenes. I like that. I like a lot of his aesthetic. I can take fast, slow, fast to a point before it gets tired. I don't feel like the characters got any real development in this. But then again, Seven Samurai and The Magnificent Seven, you really, same way, you really didn't get a lot of character development for each of the characters to for you to mourn their deaths.
Yeah.
It's just an okay movie. It's not as good as the first one. And the main bad guy, in case you didn't realize, is back. Rodrigo, resurrected him.
I don't think he adds anything
to it. So
they did at the end.
At the end of the first one. Yeah. So go into it with those expectations, and you'll be fine.
Universe Star Wars story was Magnificent Seven. Jackson the Rabbit, the first ever expanded universe.
Comic book. Yeah. We've talked about that before in the show.
Star Wars issue 7.
Ladies and gentlemen, I
do not get tired of Magnificent Seven.
No.
Stories.
I don't either. Yeah. I mean, whether it's A Bug's Life or, you know, something else, I really don't get tired of the story if it's done well. But this one is, I don't feel is done well. Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, you can join the conversation about these stories and more over on our Discord. You can join the Major Spoilers Discord server for free, and we'd love to see you join our growing community of awesome spoilerites. Link in the show notes. And we are waiting for your feedback and conversations. Also, a big thank you to everyone who supports the show and all the shows in the Major Spoilers Podcast Network. This week, we're sending thanks out to Allison Jenkins, who sent us a one-time contribution through our Linktree link. Some people have been asking, hey, can I do a one-time contribution? If you're over on the Twitter space and you see our Linktree link, or I think it's just link.tr/majorspoilers, you will find a link to make a one-time contribution if you'd like to do that. Filbert66 increased their pledge this week. Thank you, Filbert66. Julie Keel also upped their pledge to the gold level and also gets access to the VIP live chat, where I tell you what's going on behind the scenes here at Major Spoilers. And also to Ashish Gulati, who became a new member this past week and paid for a full year in advance. And when you pay for a full year in advance over at patreon.com/majorspoilers, you get a discount. It's like you pay for 11 months and you get a month free. That's a bargain. That's a bargain for me. We're waiting to give you a shout out right here on the show. We need you to join us over on our Patreon page, patreon.com/majorspoilers. Remember, when you sign up at the silver level membership, $5 a month, you get 4 bonus episodes each month that you're not going to find anywhere else. Go up to the gold level and you get up to 8 bonus episodes each month. Yeah, that's a bargain. What a bargain. Speaking of bargains, I'm convinced that this week, April 24th, 2024, might be the best week for comics this year.
Okay.
Let's run through some of the things that I'm excited about this week. Longtime fans of the Dueling Reviews know about this. But over at Archie Comics this week, Chilling Adventures presents The Cult of That Wilkin Boy, Initiation number 1. That's a one-shot. So people who like the creepy side of Archie Comics, that's out this week. We've got Boom Studios. For those of you that are big Dune fans, they continue with their Dune series over there. They've also got Mighty Morphin Power Rangers number 119, which, Matthew, I've got a story geared up for tomorrow. Let me read it here really quick. I think the Power Rangers may be coming to an end, or at least a major arc is coming to an end with the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Let me see if I can find it here really quick. It says, growing your paranoia. No, that's not it. Here we go. Mighty Morphin Power Rangers universe comes to a shocking end with Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Darkest Hour number 1. Morphin Grid in peril. The people of Earth are left without the Power Rangers to protect them. The ultimate battle against Dark Spectre will play out with unexpected consequences, while an unlikely group of rogues, villains, and rangers make strange company. But even if they win, can they rebuild everything they've lost? But I don't see anything after nearly two. Maybe they're just talking about the Darkest Hour event, because they do say here
Darkest Hour has been running for like 2 years.
Yeah, after nearly 2 years, the Darkest Hour comes to a close. This event has been one of the biggest tasks of my career, but I've enjoyed every single minute of it, says Melissa Flores, who's the current writer of the series. So maybe it's not the big thing, but July we'll see Mighty Morphin Power Rangers Darkest Hour arrive. But this week it's issue 119, so that's something to look forward to.
Yeah.
Pine and Merrimack number 4, that's a penultimate issue of that series. I've been enjoying that to pieces. Something Is Killing the Children, I haven't jumped onto, but it's like a huge hit. People have given it very positive reviews over at Major Spoilers all the time. And so we'll be reviewing that later in this year. So Something Is Killing the Children looks really good. Over at Dark Horse Comics, we have Operation Sunshine, Already Dead, number 1, that I'm looking forward to. Also, an EC Archives collection, Tales from the Crypt, Volume 3, lands this week. DC Comics has Detective Comics As Always. Flash As Always is a good run. Power Girl number 8 comes out this week. And then we get into Distillery. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Distillery or not, but they've got some really interesting projects going on. Blasphemous number 2 comes out. The art in this is really wonderful. So if you get a chance, go check that out. Dynamite Entertainment has Red Sonja number 10, which is the current run that I'm enjoying. Gargoyles Quest number 1, Rodrigo, for Gargoyles fans. Let's see, what else do they have? Oh, Thundercats number 3. And then we find out today that Chitara is getting her own series in July, a spinoff from the Thundercats series. So people who are into Chitara, you can get her adventures over at Dynamite later this year. And then who do we have down at IDW Publishing? Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles number 150, the final issue of their long-running series. Don't worry, they're going to kind of reboot, relaunch, do something completely cool in a couple of weeks. But the big 40th anniversary celebration kind of caps off with issue 150 in stores this week. Be careful, though. That has a $9.99 price tag on that. Image Comics has Duke number 5 for G.I. Joe fans. There is also... what's the other one that I was looking forward to? Universal Monsters, Creature from the Black Lagoon Lives. That one arrives this week. The covers on that look just amazing. Let's see. Who else do we have? These are just the ones that I am looking forward to reading. Mad Cave Studios has Dick Tracy number 1.
Yeah, Image is coming out with like a Universal Monsters books.
Yeah, they have. They've done Frankenstein already, I think.
Yeah, so Creature from the Black Lagoon is coming out this week. So yeah. that's interesting, definitely.
Yeah. That one will be good. Of course, over at Marvel, they got all the Spider-Mans, the Amazing Spider-Mans, the Spider-Boys, the Ultimate Spider-Mans, the Ultimate Universe number 1 comes out. Oh, that's a second printing on that one. Ultimate X-Men gets a third printing this week. So there's all the Spider-Mans that you can get your hands on. Oni Press has Rick and Morty Kingdom Balls number 1. So if you're a Rick and Morty fan, you got that. Titan Comics has Conan the Barbarian number 10, which I'm very excited for. And then who's the last one here on my list? If you're a fan of the Deathstalker / the guitarist from Guns N' Roses, is teaming up for Slash Presents Deathstalker, The Return of the Last Great Warrior King. Those are just the ones that I'm excited about this week. Oh, and maybe not excited so much as morbidly curious. Zonoscope Entertainment presents Pooh versus Bambi number 1.
Wow. I wonder if Bambi will get a rematch with Godzilla.
That one didn't end well the first time, so I doubt the second time.
I'm just saying.
You're interested in the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Is there anything else that strikes your fancy on that list? I mean, this is just a really great week for comics.
Yeah. What else did I see? Let me scroll back up.
Or Matthew, was there something you're excited about this week? I think Avengers Twilight came out last week. I thought that came out this week.
Yeah, Twilight came out last week. The Darkest Hour is the end of the Boom Studios Power Rangers, at least this continuity, quote unquote. So that's interesting. I'm really kind of looking forward to more chilling adventures.
Yeah.
Even though I feel like we're at a point where I'm like, just give me a regular series already. Mm-hmm. everybody's had their chilling adventures, and I really am kind of psyched about the latest episode of Tarot Witch of the Black Rose, because it's number 40 of 4. Think about that for a moment. Number 40 of 4.
Oh. That yeah. is a numbering that doesn't make sense.
I don't even know what that is, but I like it.
Yeah. I saw the previews for A Fox in My Brain, which is a graphic novel that's coming out. Mm-hmm. That looks pretty interesting. And of course, I probably every 4 to 6 months, I jump back to see what Vampirella is doing.
Yeah.
So that's that. Vampirella Dracula Rage is coming out. It's like number 6. So yep. Of course, it's a perfect time for me to jump on.
Yep.
On the random 6th issue, probably the end of an arc.
I think it is.
That's how I usually do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Who is the publisher that you think is hitting it out of the park right now?
Oh, that's tough.
I definitely say that, even if you don't think that it's Dark Horse, like Dark Horse has recovered incredibly from losing so many properties in the past few years.
Yes.
Like in the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
But they're, you know, they're back to doing Star Wars stuff, first off.
Yeah.
I don't know if they ever stopped.
Yeah, they did. I mean, it was only when they started doing the High Republic stuff that, because Star Wars Adventures, I want to say, was at IDW Publishing for a while, because that's when they would do the Vader's Castle stuff. And so now High Republic Adventures is now over at Dark Horse Comics.
Yeah, so they've got Star Wars stuff. They've got all the Ghostbusters stuff.
Mm-hmm. They've got all the Stranger Things stuff.
All the Stranger Things stuff. They've got Avatar, right? Yep. Actually, I think they have both Avatars, but I don't think the Last Airbender stuff is coming out right now.
Yeah,
but they have the James Cameron Avatar stuff they got as well. Yep.
Yeah, they've been great at recovering. I thought whenever they lost Predator, Aliens, Star Wars, and what was the other big one that they lost that I was just like, ooh, this is going to be rough to recover from. Oh, yeah, Buffy, when it went over to Boom. I thought that, ooh, this is going to be rough. And then, you know, they come back. They were able to lure, what's his name? Yojimbo. Usagi Yojimbo,
Stan
Sakai. They were able to bring him over to Dark Horse with all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
They brought Brian Michael Bendis and his Jinx World over to Dark Horse. I believe Miller World is now over at Dark Horse as well.
Yeah. So, and of course, there are just brand new series also starting up that are not tied to other properties. Mm-hmm. But for a while there, so much of Dark Horse stuff was like Star Wars, Rebel Alliance, Star Wars, under Vader's helmet, Star Wars, you know, like...
Well,
like
scroll
that
down
all
to the,
went away.
You scroll down to the Marvel section. This week at Marvel, it's Star Wars Darth Maul, Black, White, and Red, number 1. Star Wars Dr. Aphra, volume 7. That series has concluded. Star Wars Jango Fett, number 2. I was going to say Star Wars Superior Spider-Man. But yeah, they've got a ton of Star Wars stuff coming out every week from Marvel. Somebody had posted the other day, it's like, why did Disney take away all of these properties only to, you know, from the
not
smaller
do
publishers,
anything with them?
Not to do anything with them. And then now everybody's picking them back up. And I pointed out that it's like, no, when those contracts with Boom and Dynamite and Dark Horse all ended, Disney took the option and said, we're not going to renew those contracts. They did try to do stuff at Marvel for a while, including traditional Disney comics. Remember Haunted House and the, Haunted Mansion and, Thunder Mountain and a bunch of other stuff. And then none of that stuff really gelled at Marvel. And so Disney was like, okay, then I guess we'll open this back up to anybody else who wants to take a crack at this stuff. So Dark Horse has got a bunch of that stuff. Boom Studios has again been doing great with their Disney stuff. They've got the Hercules. They've got their Disney Villains line, which is really good. And then the Gargoyles thing, which I think is a huge win. That not enough people are paying attention to.
Yeah,
Dynamite, too? not Boom, Dynamite Entertainment.
Yeah, they have Darkwing too, and I'm like,
Darkwing Duck and the Justice Ducks or whatever it is.
Yeah, and that's the thing is like all of those Disney afternoon properties have like huge built-in audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So
you
hope that they're cashing in at least with all that stuff.
So I don't know. I think this is a really great week for comics. I'm very excited about stuff that's coming out this week. I've probably been more excited about comics coming out this week than I have in a while, right? It's you know, I can't think of a time where I'm like, there's more than a dozen comics that I want to read this week. And they're not all from the same publisher, right?
Yeah.
They are really spread out across the world.
That's the nice thing, right? That's like the healthy thing. We want there to be lots of publishers putting out lots of different comics that are mm-hmm. very different from each other. Yeah, mm-hmm. definitely.
Yeah. I'm even looking at next week. All the annuals come out. So it's next week, a fifth week. Next week is May 1st, right?
I don't think it's a traditional fifth week. I want to say May 1st comes on, on Wednesday.
It's a Wednesday. So it's not a fifth week, but I'm looking ahead. It looks like DC has got a bunch of their annuals coming out next week. I don't have a complete list here. Let's see what else is. Distillery is, again, people need to go check them out. They're doing some interesting things. Lilo and Stitch, so Dynamite has a bunch of Disney stuff next week. Disney Villains, Cruella de Vil, Maleficent comes out, Gargoyles Halloween special, Lilo and Stitch, number 3, Negaduck. Next week is Space Ghost. Space Ghost with Matthew. Do you want to guess how many covers there are for Space Ghost number 1? This is an old thing that we used to do. Space Ghost number 1.
13, 14, no, 16.
A lot more. Keep going.
Wow.
How many?
27.
No, less than that.
57.
Okay. Oh. No.
21.
More than that. 20, 18. How many letters in the alphabet?
24.
There are 25 covers coming out next week.
Wow.
For Space Ghost number 1.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I mean, it's got to be doing something, right?
So people are excited about this series.
How many of them are by Steve Rude?
Let's see. None of them. We have Francesco Mattina, Jay Lee, Bjorn Behrens, Frank Cho. There's a blank authentics variant. And then you have variations, foil variants and line art variants. But those are nude the four variants. Main. No. Dynamite doesn't do the nude variants. Man, I don't know. I get a lot of weird emails from Zenoscope lately that makes me wonder that whenever I talk about comics or... comics are horny. They're the ones that are like leaning into like these X-rated prints that they're selling through their store and stuff. It's really weird.
They always have, though. I mean, Xenoscope used to make big bucks on their topless variants.
Oh, okay. They just never put me on their mailing list for all of those things. And it's like, wow, in the last couple of 6 months or so, it's just been like every day there's a new... Have you seen the new X-rated version or the R-rated version? I'm like, I don't really care about those. I've got other sites that I can go get that stuff.
Yeah, you get like a main cover that was Belinda in her outfit, and then you'd have like a racy cover, and then you'd have a topless cover, and then you'd have a fully nude cover. Then you'd have a seeing through her skin to her dermis cover. And it's just like... But
I mean, you know,
they're if they're making, they go and they sell for $50.
Yeah, no, if people are making money off it, I don't have a problem with it. I'm just saying that it's only been in my face a lot more in the last 6 months than it was before. So, so I'm still recovering from computer failure, and still finding files and things that I have lost or misplaced or things that have been deleted. Over the years, I do need to get a new computer. So if people want to contribute to a new computer fund, that would be great. That way we can keep this show coming out at you all the time. But one file that I did stumble upon, Zach on Film 1984. Mm-hmm. The best and the worst 1984 had to offer. This was what going to be the next movie podcast that we did. Just looking at the year 1984 and looking at, right now on my list that this one has 36 different movies. So yeah.
Interesting.
It is very interesting.
Something to bring back.
Starts out with the movie 1984 and ends with Top Secret. And in between, I mean, 1984, I'm going to argue is probably one of the best years in movies. And I know people are like, I don't agree with you, but I mean, listen to this. This is just a partial list. Because what year did Gremlins come out?
84.
Did that come out in 84?
I believe so, yeah.
Gremlins is not... Oh, yeah, it came out in 1984. What year did Karate Kid come out?
84, I think.
No, 1984. Oh. It's also not... Oh, no, I do have Karate Kid on this list. Gremlins is not on this list for whatever reason. I think because
well,
maybe...
You did it wrong.
No. I think it's because we did Gremlins already on Zach on Film.
That could be it.
But 1984, 2010, the year we make contact, Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, Beverly Hills Cop, Body Double, The Cotton Club, Dreamscape, Dune, Firestarter, Footloose, Chud, Ghostbusters, The Ice Pirates, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, The Karate Kid, The Killing Fields, The Last Starfighter, Missing in Action, The Muppets Take Manhattan, Nausicaa, Valley of the Winds, Neverending Story, Nightmare on Elm Street, Once Upon a Time in America, Once Upon a Time in America, and Beverly Hills Cop both came out in the same year, just to kind of put that into perspective. Pope of Greenwich Village, Purple Rain, Repo Man, I Want to Do Crimes, 16 Candles, Splash, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, Starman, The Natural, Stranger Than Paradise, Supergirl, The Terminator, This Is Spinal Tap, and Top Secret. All of those movies came out in 1984.
Temple of Doom.
Yeah, I did mention that one already.
Okay. Did you say Nightmare on Elm Street?
I did mention that one.
Terminator?
Terminator, I just mentioned that one.
Red Dawn.
Red Dawn's not on this list.
Okay.
But the thing
right
is...
stuff.
No. again, so this is just a sampling of
right.
what it could be. Right Stuff came out in 83, by the way.
Are you sure?
Yes. Red Dawn did come out in 84. Unless you're talking about the 2012 flop. But things that might have been, ladies and gentlemen, things that might have been or could be. Of course, it wouldn't be Zach. I bumped into Zach the other day at the store, and he just kind of ignored me and wandered around with his basket of tofu and sprouts.
Footloose. Hot Dog, I think, came out that year. Did Spring Break come out that year?
Don't know. I'd have to go look at the list, but this is the best and the worst of 1984 all in one place. 1984, again, I argue, is probably the best year for movies ever.
Have you seen the internet meme that says, was it a great movie or did it just come out when you were 13?
No, we've talked about that before, right? We've already had that long conversation about, you know, the year that you are, that's your formative years. That's when the best movies came out. But if you just look at this list that I mentioned, these are not only great movies, these are defining movies. And in some case, great movies.
Genre defining movies, Revenge of the Nerds, Purple Rain.
Yeah.
Just
I mean, there's good stuff and bad stuff in this thing. So, yeah, I found that while I was cleaning.
Always worth asking the question of yourself, right? I'm there with music, where like something
1984
will...
was the best year for music.
No, but for me, it's closer to like 1997 or something like that, right?
Right.
And I'm like, man, oh man, this song was great, and this song was great, and I've gone back and re-listened to some stuff, and I'm like. Actually, this isn't very good. It just came out when I was looking for music. And there's other stuff where I'm like, actually, this is really good and has been basically erased from like the musical canon of the time, right? Nobody goes back and plays Where's Your Head At by Basement Jacks anymore.
Yeah.
Right. Scatman Jacks.
So yeah, I just did a quick question to Google. What was the best year for music? And according to Nerdist, the greatest single year in pop music history, we think that award goes to 1984.
76.
Sure. Then I also see some other people saying 91 might be the greatest year of music ever. And then Cleveland.com, maybe because of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
They say 1969, 1971, 91. 67, 70, 68, 84. 1984 comes in at number 7 for them. 1973, 1977, and 1966 are the top 10.
See, 91 cannot be the best year for music because it had Billy Ray Cyrus and Vanilla Ice. You have to take the whole
notable albums in 1991. Nirvana's Nevermind, Pearl Jam 10, U2 Octoon Baby, REM Out of Time, Michael Jackson's Dangerous, Metallica the Black Album, Guns N' Roses Use Your Illusions 1 and 2, Red Hot Chili Peppers Blood Sex Sugar Magic, A Tribe Called Quest The Low End Theory, Soundgarden's Bad Motor Finger, De La Soul with De La Soul Is Dead, Primal Scream, Massive Attack, and Ice Cube all had notable albums in 1991.
Yeah, the KLF put out their last album that year featuring the massive 3AM Eternal, wonderful album.
1984.
Cypress L.
Yeah.
1984 had Prince's Purple Rain, Bruce Springsteen's Born in the USA, Echo and the Bunnymen, Ocean Rain, Van Halen's 1984, Husker Du, Zen Arcade, Sade's Diamond Life, The Replacements, Let It Be, U2, The Unforgettable Fire, Metallica, Ride the Lightning, The Smiths, Bob Marley, Legend, Madonna, Like a Virgin, and Tina Turner, Private Dancer, came out that year. That's a good year of music right there.
I preferred 83. I do this thing where I tell the unnamed household music player / assistant to play music from a specific year. And so far, the best years for me are 83 and 76.
What came out in 83?
I don't know. Peter Schilling's Major Tom.
Mm.
There's a Journey song. I think it may be Don't Stop Believin'. I don't even remember. I could ask her now and she would play it and I'd be just like, oh. But yeah, it's good music to go to sleep to if you're old and like super.
Don't Stop Believing came out in 81.
So it may actually be the other one.
If You Leave Me Now by Chicago came out in 76.
Yep.
More Than a Feeling came out in 76.
Yep.
Come Sail Away came out in 77.
Yep.
So
Dirty Deeds.
I don't know. I think 84. I think let's look at what was the greatest year? Greatest year for
Metal Health came out in 83.
I'm very bad at knowing when music came out. Like I'll listen to a new song and find out that it's literally from like 1996. Right. And I just missed it somehow.
Spandau Ballet True, which gave us not just True, but Gold, which is the greatest Spandau Ballet song ever, came out in 83.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, listeners? 1984 may be the best year for pop culture ever. Go look it up. Go look it up and share your feedback over on the Discord server.
Great year,
83. Before we get out of here, Rodrigo, you have a magic card challenge. I'm sorry. I'm not going to get into your crazy magic card challenge games. I don't have that kind of money anymore.
Okay, that's good. I'm actually not spending pretty much any money on magic nowadays. Magic's had a few dozen hiccups in the past few years. So mostly I'm not spending a lot of money on magic cards. I'm playing magic with my friends, which is kind of the reason why I'm still sort of plugged in. But what I wanted to do was there's a new, relatively new set that's come out called Outlaws of Thunder Junction. It's like a cowboy
one
set.
Yeah.
Yep. And I wanted to see if you guys could figure out what these mechanics do just from the name.
I can try.
So I'm going to show you a card. I'm going to put it here in the chat.
Okay.
And then I'll describe it for the people at home. So we're looking at Rustler Rampage. It's a white card. It costs one white. It's an instant. The picture is a picture of like a cowboy riding like a big steer or cow, and then a bunch of other cows kind of stampeding behind him. It's an instant. It's an uncommon. It has the keyword spree, which says choose one or more additional costs. Plus one colorless, untappable creatures target player controls. Plus one colorless, target creature gains double strike until end of turn. Flavor text, release the cows. Okay. Steven and or Matthew, how do you play this card?
So remind me, if a card is tapped, can I attack it?
You can't attack individual things unless they're planeswalkers or battles nowadays.
So, but if a card is untapped, though, that's what I can use to block stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, then I'm confused on this one, because I would think that if I could attack with cards that are untapped, I would want all of my opponent's cards to be untapped so that I could stampede him.
You would want him to be tapped.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Right. So that doesn't make sense. So I would want to create some kind of a stampede to...
But you're a player too.
Yeah, I know, but right. I'm trying to kill
you
all of his guys.
You can untap all of your creatures. So I feel like you do your
all the creatures the target player controls. So I could be the target.
Right, so you target yourself.
Oh, so this allows you to...
all of your creatures.
This allows me to attack, untap all of my creatures, have them attack again, and I can add a +1 onto a target creature, doubling the strike. So it's basically letting me do my turn twice.
So how much mana do you have to pay to do all of that?
A minimum of 3, because it says untap all creatures target player controls.
Right.
So with one additional land or whatever, or point, I can untap everybody. Oh no, because then you have to, because does it cost to attack?
Creature, so it's untap. And
yeah,
then...
only if you want them to be double, right? So I would probably only double my highest attack creature. So if you're doing a Rob thing where he does that crazy sheep thing, you know,
his goat's deck,
his goat deck. Mm-hmm. You could overrun somebody just with a goat deck. But if you've got 10 cards that you untap, but one of them is like a 6/10 or something like that, then maybe you double that one up. So a minimum of 3, a maximum of, infinite, I guess.
Okay.
Why a minimum of 3?
3 is
one
the
to
correct
play
answer.
The card. One to play the card, one for the spree, one for the target creature.
That is correct. To get all of the effects, you pay 3, and you actually can't pay more into this card. You could pay 2 to get either effect, or you could pay 3 to get all 3 of them, right? Choose one or more additional costs.
Yeah.
Is what Spree says. Okay, good. That was very good. You basically sussed it out. Okay.
Yay.
The next couple ones are basically impossible, but let's look at them anyway.
Okay.
Oh boy.
That one came out kind of small, but click on it. So we are looking at Duelist of the Mind.
Okay.
One colorless, one blue. Okay, let me send it.
Okay. Unless it's supposed to be hidden and we're not supposed to see it.
Nope.
Okay.
You should be able to see it now.
Yep. Duelist of the Mind.
Duelist of the Mind. One colorless, one blue. Mm-hmm. So it's a blue card. It's a creature, human advisor. It's a rare. It has flying, vigilance, and Duelist of the Mind's power is equal to the number of cards you've drawn this turn. Whenever you commit a crime, you may draw a card. If you do, discard a card. This ability triggers only once each turn. And the flavor text is Nathan Stewart, world champion,
28.
That's what it is. So this is a card that was designed by a world champion, and actually the character here is his likeness. That doesn't super matter. So it has flying. You guys know what flying does. Vigilance basically allows you to attack without tapping, and its power is equal to how many cards you've drawn this turn. So on your turn, its power is always going to be 1. On an opponent's turn, you would have to figure out a way to draw a card to get it above 0.
Yeah, but he's flying,
But what I wanted to figure out is, what do you guys think it means to commit a crime? Because it says, whenever you commit a crime, you may draw a card. What do you think committing a crime is?
My guess is killing another creature the opponent controls.
Okay. Matthew, what do you think?
Boy, I don't know. That sounds legit, but I think there's got to be something specific. I don't know if there's a specific thing that like a specific mechanic where you're breaking the laws of physics.
I mean, just take a guess what, you know, if you were designing a mechanic called commit a crime or whatever, you know, again, like, what do you think it entails?
This is an Old West themed deck.
Yep.
Ah, rob a bank.
Okay.
Shoot the witnesses, stampede the cattle.
Okay. Rob a bank, shoot the witnesses, stampede the cattle. Not far off. Neither one of you are far off. Technically, Steven could be correct if it's done in a particular way. What committing a crime is basically casting a spell or activating an ability that targets an opponent's permanence or the opponent themselves or anything in their graveyard. So basically anything that you do that is like a one-to-one thing that messes with an opponent is committing a crime.
Okay. That's cool.
That makes sense.
It's interesting because this is something that you're doing anyway in most decks.
Is a crime.
Yeah, it's like it's weird because they flavor it as a crime, but this is something that you do in Magic anyway all the time. But this is a way to sort of make a new mechanic that already has functionality, right? It's like you target your opponent and their creatures and their stuff all the time. So all of these commit a crime cards just already like reward you for something that you were already doing, right? Yeah, so it's interesting. Yeah. But it's also funny that like now, like literally doing anything to your opponent is committing a crime, which outside of the context of this set is going to continue to exist. This is now written into the rules. So even if you're playing like Kaldheim stuff, if you're playing the Viking set, like you're still committing crimes by like shooting fireballs at people.
Yeah.
Which I guess maybe is okay. Okay. Here's the last one.
Okay.
So we're looking at Calamity, Galloping Inferno. It is 6 mana. 4 colorless, 2 red, so it's a red creature, legendary creature, horse mount. It's a rare. It has haste, and whenever Calamity, Galloping Inferno, attacks while saddled, choose a non-legendary creature that saddled it this turn, and create a tapped and attacking token that's a copy of it. Sacrifice that token at the beginning of the next end step, repeat this process once. And it has saddle 1. It's a 4/6. So what this creature does is once it's been saddled and it attacks, it makes a copy of a creature of one of the creatures that saddled it. My question to you is, how do you think you saddle a creature? So this is a horse, right? Again, cowboy-themed. This is a mount, right? This is like a magic, spooky horse. And I should say that the art is like a spooky horse that has a fiery rider on top of it.
Something that has to do with adding a token to the card.
Like adding a counter?
Yeah.
Okay.
And so whoever's, you know, there's got to be somebody that allows you to saddle by adding, and that would be your turn, right? So I'm betting that there's more than one character that will allow you to do this, but like a stable hand or a livery guy.
Okay. So there's like,
who has you the think ability there are to like, saddle.
You would say there are cowboy cards that specifically have a mechanic that locks into saddle.
Yeah. Because you remember with flying, there's also characters that can attack flying and there's characters that can't attack flying. So I imagine that there are probably characters that can saddle and not saddle. So as you're building up your deck, you would want somebody that can saddle to apply the token onto your horse. That person would then, that card would then be tapped. Right. And then you get to make a copy of that card that also looks like it comes in tapped.
Yeah, it comes in tapped and attacking. So basically.
Oh, okay. So it can attack. Yeah.
The horse attacks and it makes a copy of that creature tapped and attacking.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, do you have to play Conjunction Junction cards only with Conjunction Junction other cards, or can you play it with other sets?
You can, depending on the format, you can play with any set. So if you were going to play standard, you would get Thunder Junction plus like 5 other sets.
So my thinking is, since he makes a copy of what I'm saddling it with. I'm sacrificing cards.
Okay.
Like say I have, say I have three phthalates, and I take my phthalates and I sacrifice my phthalates, and then Calamity makes three new phthalates who are then riding him into battle. I don't know. Is there like a limitation?
You can only do it once.
Well, so it's one a saddle time. One. So that probably is some sort of limitation, right?
Right. Okay. So I figure if it's saddle one, you take one creature, mm-hmm. you sacrifice the creature. It then creates a copy of it that is now riding the Inferno. And since I can repeat it, I'm like sacrificing like the token. So like I'm basically killing a creature and turning it into a ghost that is with the horsey. And then
you're basically turning it into like two creatures.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I'm basically the ghost horse is saying now this creature is riding a ghost horse. And so it and the ghost horse are now like fighting together on the thing. That's how it makes the copy of the creature thing.
Okay. All right. So you guys neither one of you is too far off. Staddle cares about power. So it doesn't matter what, and power is like the first number slash toughness, right?
Right.
So four is Calamity's power, six is its toughness. So Staddle one means it needs, Staddle is based on another mechanic called crew. And crew is for vehicles. So if you have a ship and it says crew two, then you need to tap two power worth of creatures to crew it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it basically comes alive and can now attack and deal damage, right? So you can do, if something has crew two, you can tap two 1/1 creatures, or you can tap one creature that's a 2/2, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
All you need is two power. So anywhere that you can like sort that out, that crews the thing. Staddle works the same way. So if this had saddle three, you could do three 1-power creatures, a 2 and a 1, or a 3-power creature, or actually more. You could saddle it with a 4/4, and that extra power would just be wasted.
But but it says here you get a copy of that one creature. That right. One level creature, so, one power creature.
So basically, to saddle a creature, Steven, you don't need a specific card that clicks into that.
Okay.
That said, because this set has the saddle mechanic, it does have cards that reward you for using them as the rider, basically, for saddling another creature.
Okay.
But that's not like, that's not a rules interaction. That's like an individual card
interaction.
Right,
that's
a
bonus thing, bonus action.
Yeah. So basically the way that you do this is, let's say you do have a 1/1 thalid. What you do is you tap that thalid, and now Calamity is saddled, which means it gets any bonuses it says from being saddled. So it attacks. And then basically two thalids pop into the battlefield, tapped and attacking. To 1/1 identical copies to your thalid. Yeah. So, Matthew, you were basically right, except you don't lose the creature. You just temporarily have to tap it. But that's good. So here's the thing. The reason why I picked these cards is because they're wordy enough that they didn't include the flavor text. So I wanted to see if you guys could like suss out what it could possibly mean to commit a crime to saddle a creature. I couldn't find any spree cards that didn't have the flavor text, not the flavor text, but the rules text. But I think you guys did really well for guys that aren't like, don't have their nose stuck up magic, like Rob or I do a lot of the time.
Yeah.
That's good for the game that you guys came so close to it, because it means that people that aren't playing magic all the time can sort of figure it out, especially if they do have the, because even if you have the rules text, it's still very complicated, right? Mm-hmm. Definitely a saddle is a complicated mechanic. You need to tap certain creatures to activate the card, but it doesn't do anything else. The thing with crew is that if a vehicle is not crewed, it can't attack. It's not a creature. Its power and toughness don't matter. And then it becomes a creature when you crew it, so you can use it to interact, to attack, or to block. But creatures that have saddle are already creatures, so saddling them doesn't do anything. It just says, okay, here's a check mark. It is now saddled, and anything in its text box that cares about it being saddled is now in play. So
you could attack and still get a 4/6 out of it, or you could get a 4/6 plus 2/1 power attack.
Yeah,
as well.
I mean, no matter. Yeah, so yeah, you're right. You can attack with it unsaddled, or if you saddle it, you're going to get some tokens out of the deal.
Yeah,
and
so that's, I mean, that's interesting.
Yeah, and but because I it can be any creature that there are some powerful creatures that have enter the battlefield abilities. So if you saddle something big that like gives you a ton of life or puts up on your counters on things, and then all of a sudden two of those pop into existence, you could actually get some big plays out of it. Right?
Okay, because that's what that was going to be my question is, it seems like you're only getting a slight bump in power or attack, I guess, because of what you're using to saddle, because I'm thinking one, I'm only going to spin to one creature, but you could, if you had a 6/6 creature that had, I don't know, what is it? Ramp or trample, I guess, is where you bust over the guards.
Mm-hmm.
So you could end up with two 6/6 creatures that trample and bust on through and commit a crime. And then the duelist of the mind is there to say, and now you're on your way to powering up those cards.
Actually, Steven, that is an excellent point and something that I hadn't thought of. With crewing a vehicle, you want to crew it with the least amount of power available, right? Or necessary.
Right.
So if something is a power 2 creature, or if something is crew 2, you want to tap only 2 power so that you have other available creatures to also attack with the vehicle most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
With something like this, with Saddle, this specific card, you would actually be happy to tap this with a 5/5 trampler because it would then attack and you would get 10 power with trample on top of the 4 that is already attacking, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's a great observation. You actually probably want to saddle this thing with a Baeloth, which are like a huge beast, which then would give you that guy from Dark Souls, right? Elden Ring, like that giant guy who's riding a tiny horse.
Yeah.
So you can get that too.
So trample allows you to go ignore the blockers, right? And attack the player directly.
Basically, when you block all damage. Trample says you only block as much as your toughness.
Ah, okay.
So if you have, right now, right? Calamity doesn't have trample. So if you put a 1/1 in front of it, blocked. The 1/1 dies, but it's blocked.
Right.
If it had trample, then the 1/1 blocks it, and more damage would roll through to the opponent.
Ah, to the opponent. So then that would be a crime then.
No, that is not a crime because it doesn't target. See, that's the thing that that is real tricky about that. And that's kind of what I was getting at with these cards is like lots of things. If you're like, okay, a crime is anytime you mess with your opponent, right? You're like, okay, well, I attack him and I hit him. That's a crime, right? It's like, no. Like, weirdly, if you have a card that says target player draws a card and you do it at your opponent, making your opponent draw a card, which is usually a good thing, is a crime. But launching a spectral horse that then makes two giant beasts appear behind it and hitting it for like 14 damage is actually not a crime.
Yeah, interesting.
So like if I was to do something where I took control of one of your creatures, so like I take control of one of your creatures, but you still own it.
Yeah.
And I throw the thing on it.
And you're like, you activate Calamity?
Or say I seal one of your creatures.
Mm-hmm.
You still own it. I'm controlling it, and I put a force field on it to make it more powerful and hit you. By putting that force field on something that you own, did I just commit a crime?
I don't think so. I think it has to be things they control. However, if somebody steals your creature and you say...
Oh, that's a crime.
If somebody steals your creature by targeting it, that's a crime.
Yeah.
If you then say... First off, if you originally targeted the creature to steal it, that's a crime. Stealing the creature is a crime.
Right.
Targeting that creature then is no longer a crime. But if somebody stole your creature and you say, if I can't have it, nobody can, and you kill your own creature that they're controlling, that's a crime. But if you kill your own creature, if you kill your own creature that you're controlling, that's not a crime.
Yeah, so I guess my hopes for my red-blue deck have just gone out the window.
Oh, it's
because then I would get a couple of 5/5, a couple of 5/5 tramplers, saddle them up, blast on through, hit the damage on the opponent, and then my duelist of the mind can come in and say, "Oh, you could also do this," And I'd be like, ha, 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 you thought he was just hovering there, doing nothing. And I've played however many cards it took to... Wait, it's how many cards you played or how many cards you drew this turn? Oh.
Yeah, but anytime you commit a crime, he draws you a card. So if you were playing what Matthew's saying, right, you've got Duelist mm-hmm. of the Mind mm-hmm. and you've got Calamity mm-hmm. on the board. You steal an opponent's creature, like they've got a badass creature. You play a spell to steal it. Now you've committed a crime. Duelist of the Mind lets you draw a card. Right? So now you've got extra cards in hand.
Now I got a 1/3.
Then you say, now I'm going to use your creature, your badass, super cool creature that I stole, to saddle Calamity and attack you. Now Calamity is going to make 2 token copies of a creature that doesn't even belong, like of a creature that doesn't even belong to you, that you stole from someone else. You're going to hit them with that. And then even if the creature returns to them at the end of turn, which a lot of healing creature spells do, you still get to keep the tokens. So you've committed at least 1 crime in the process and gotten a whole bunch of damage.
And so now he can...
And gotten 1 card. So now it's a 2/2. So it probably... And it can fly. So you probably wanted to send it
be like a
along
2/3,
with
right?
Calamity.
Yeah.
So you would draw 1 card. And if you only stole 1 creature, it would be a 2/3. Yeah.
Yeah.
So...
Yeah, but
listen. Now I'm doing a 2/3. I've got 10 from the 2 trample characters. And I've got 4. That's like 19 right there, right? Or 16. 10,
14, 15, 16. Yeah, 16. You could in that magnificent turn, you could do up to 16 damage, which if you've had this guy on the board for a while, you've probably been nickel and diming your opponent a little bit. So they could very well be at 16 or below.
So throw Rustler Rampage in with that. Mm-hmm. And the game's over. These are 3, I think, game-ending cards, but it's going to take you a while to build up to these cards.
Yeah, not only... So part of the issue here is that there are 3 different... there are 3 different colors, right?
Yeah. Well,
first off, you need a 3-color deck to cast them. Second, Calamity is expensive, right? 6 mana.
Yeah.
If you're just playing, if you're just dropping a land per turn, that's a turn 6 drop. Turn 6 it does have haste, so it can go on turn 6. So yeah, maybe you drop... You have your...
Man, you need a lot of defense, though. You need to be putting a lot of defense in those first 6 turns, though. Because otherwise, if you're just waiting for Calamity to come out, if Calamity comes out...
So the nice thing is that Duelist of the Mind has flying and vigilance. So it doesn't tap to attack. So it can block and it can attack on consecutive turns, right? So if you attack with it, it doesn't tap. That means it's available to block. Yeah. So and actually, Spree is a very defensive card. So on your opponent's turn, you could cast Rustler's Ramp. Like, they attack you with, like, a smaller creature because they're not going to get their 10-10s online right away either, right?
Yeah, yeah.
They attack with a smaller creature. You play Spree for 3. You untap any other creatures you had. You say Duelist of the Mind. Oh, actually, that wouldn't be a crime. So actually, he wouldn't get... Because you're targeting... If you're targeting your own creature, you could untap one of the opponent's creatures and then he would draw a card, but you don't necessarily want to do that. So
right.
It's all of these rules interact with each other. Yeah. But overall, what I'm saying is good job on you guys for kind of like getting very close, and good job on Magic for making mechanics that are pretty close to a place where people would figure them out. So
yeah. I think that's pretty good, but cool. I think still it's the man. We just nerded out for like 20 minutes, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
But that's what you came
content,
for, right?
Content warning. There's a 20-minute small game show / brew session for Magic the Gathering at the end of this podcast.
Write that all down so I can make it the title. Let's see. I'm going to just say, instead of general topic, major spoilers, it is warning. There is a 20-minute, what did you say? 20-minute?
Magic the Gathering, or like there's Gathering. A 20-minute game show / game brew show. Session for Magic the Gathering at the end of this podcast.
There's a monster at the end of this book.
End of this podcast. Make sure that's right. That may be too long for any kind of a...
Oh, sure.
For just, any kind of a title, but it's still funny.
You can make that the description if you want, that in the description. But sounded like you guys had a good time. I think it's interesting if the audience thought this was fun.
I think they might not fair because, number of people that do. Yeah, some people aren't into magic, but here's the thing. There are a lot of our listeners who do play CCGs, whether that be like me with Sentinels of the Multiverse or Legendary. You know, just me playing those two games, or even what's the other legendary card game from Fantasy Flight or whoever it is, Upper Deck. Just by going through even what some people might consider lesser games than Magic, it's still getting that logic being built up into you so that when you do approach a game like Magic that may be a little bit more wordy and complicated, that logic system is still built into you from those other games that it starts to make sense.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. All right, ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Again, if you found some value in this 20-minute game show / brew session for Magic the Gathering, and you want to maybe hear more of that in the future, head over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/majorspoilers. A small monthly contribution, $5 a month, will do wonders for us. Again, patreon.com/majorspoilers. Next week on the show, we are revisiting That Texas Blood with That Texas Blood Volume 2. Rand Bellavia was scheduled to be here next week, but he has had to miss the last two sessions, one because of a meeting. The other one is because next week he's hosting a barbershop quartet event, so he's got to miss for that. But the other big news, and everybody should go out and congratulate Ookla the Mock on Twitter, formerly X, because Ookla the Mock was inducted into the Philk Hall of Fame over the weekend. Next time Rand is on the show, we are going to grill him about that. Why? Because we know that you love Philk music, and we do too, and we will talk with you soon.
Fat Dick's Ray Vision of Superman. I could save a few bucks and stand around and read through the covers of the comics on the stand. But although every other page would be backwards, I suppose I could still read the evens and the odds. Well, I don't know. Guess I haven't thought this all the way through. Plus, as soon as the comic book store got here, they kicked my butt out on the corner. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. When I think about a better way, if I was hulking green or gray, I could just bust through that brick wall, take their comic books away. But then the little meat would deal with all the tanks and bombs and guns. Have you ever tried to read a series with all that going on? Guess I need to rethink this plan. How would I back and board my comics with such huge hands? Guess I already told ya. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. I'm Stark Raven, rich like a man of iron. Might not be surprised to find that I might actually have the heart cold to follow an entire storyline. Would I really even need to read up on all those escapades? I mean, who needs such distractions when your sister's such a babe? But the downside is such a beast. Being shot up in a fun, being in the Middle East with a king, son, throwing soldier. What a major spoiler. What a major spoiler. Yeah. What a major spoiler, whoa. What a major spoiler.
This podcast is copyright 2024 by Major Spoilers Entertainment, LLC.